School. I'm your host, Grace Jung. It is US Open week, and I have not been watching tennis all that much. I guess it's a sign that I am busy, that I have a schedule, and that I have a life, because when I first got here in July, I was obsessed with Wimbledon, and I watched like every single game. But now I'm just like, okay, I guess I'm not gonna watch US Open. I'll just catch like a game or two if I'm at the gym or if I'm at a bar and it happens to be on. But honestly, like, I don't care as much, you know? And I thought I did. Like, I put it on my schedule. I put it on my calendar. I was like, I need to get ESPN. And here's the thing, I got fucking ESPN. And it costs something like $12 or $13 a month. And guess what? I need to have a TV service in order to have access to ESPN. So that means I'm gonna be shelling out like another $70. So it's like 80 something dollars to catch a week's worth of tennis. I don't wanna do that, yeah? Like, that seems stupid. I don't know. Also, why is it so hard to just fucking stream live tennis? Why does it have to be such a thing? I thought if I had Peacock, I could watch it. But no, turns out no, that's not an option. On Peacock, I can only watch, like, you know, the Olympics that they have for people with disabilities. Yeah, that's what they have. But they don't have US Open. Like, why would you say that US Open is exclusive to Peacock if it's not? Like, I wasted like two whole days trying to figure this shit out. So fucking ridiculous. Anyway, got that out of the way. I spoke to a former professor of mine. She is the professor emeritus of UCLA in the department that I graduated from. Her name is Vivian Sopcich, and she's a dear professor because I learned a lot from her. And one of her observations of me is that I'm a very angry person. And that is true, I am. But that's not all of me. That's just one very big aspect of me. And she was like, you know, it makes sense that you do stand-up because you have a lot of anger. I'm like, yeah. And honestly, anger is very useful when being a stand-up comedian. It is also very useful when writing. It's also very useful when coming up with projects, you know? Like, there's a lot that I do out of vindictive rage. And yeah, it's perfect fuel in a lot of ways. So I embrace it. I don't see anything wrong with it, personally. Today, I'm going to continue talking about the show The Frog. And I was revisiting the show earlier this evening to just, like, work out some kinks. And turns out I was watching it maybe inaccurately. Yeah, I didn't realize that we were looking at two different timelines. So there's kind of like a parallel between the couple with the young son, the motel owner of Lakeview, and then there is the older gentleman with the murderous young woman at his current pension. And these are two different timelines. I didn't realize that. I had to rewatch it in order to make sense of it. Of course, it makes sense later. Yeah, but like, turns out there were clues about these things being separate timelines from the beginning. I mean, I thought the scene of the young woman, the murderer, okay, the woman who killed her stepson. I think her actions and her behavior are really interesting to watch because, like, I'm just trying to figure out like what her problem is. Like, what is this show trying to point to as the problem that we need to address or fix? And I feel like that kept changing episode after episode. So when I was watching it from like the episode where she's, you know, oh, like she's a painter, she's an artist, and she's also a spoiled brat who comes from a lot of wealth and privilege. And she has this gallery owner person who she's supposed to work with, and she's abusive towards the gallery owner. And she shows up at her own art show and drives a vehicle in through the window and is like throwing a fit and all that stuff. I was just like, is this trying to point out the fact that she's just a really bad person? Or that this is how serial killers behave? Or that this is just a psychopath? Like, what is the bigger socio-cultural or socio-economic issue that's trying to be addressed here? I thought perhaps maybe it has something to do with, like, once a person reaches a certain level of comfort, when they have too much of it, they start becoming dementedly cruel. And that is what she is. She is dementedly cruel. So perhaps that is in there somewhere, but it's not like starkly clear, you know? Also, it's like, isn't that kind of a given? Like we've seen this narrative told many times before. I thought it was interesting as the show progressed when the pension owner is now trying to hunt down the killer in his own house and she won't leave. Like, that was interesting. Suddenly the tables had turned and she is now the victim in his house and he's trying to murder her. Like, when he was coming after her with the gun and stuff, I was like, okay, like, what am I looking at here? This is a very interesting like perspective shift, you know, because the whole time in this horror thriller genre, she was the antagonist. But now it's like, as the antagonist, you could see her suffering and trying to survive. Like, so this cat and mouse play is like bouncing back and forth. I also thought it was so strange whenever the pension owner and this murderer lady would like sit down and eat together. What is that about? Like, they had such intimacy between them. Why? Why are they so intimate? Like, there's no attraction, but there is some kind of tension. Why are these two people drawn to each other? What is the meeting point? What is the deal? And ultimately, it had to do with the truth. You know, like if she's playing the clown role, this trickster clown role, and he's the hero that needs to go through this journey. I mean, his baggage is that he could not face the truth. He couldn't admit to it. He couldn't just say she murdered her son or her stepson. She did it in my pension. She cleaned it all up, and I'm living with this lie, and it's eating me alive. And he just couldn't fess up the truth, and she knew he couldn't. So that becomes her game. Yeah. So, whenever they sat down to eat together and hang out together, like this intimacy that was going on between them, it's like, what is keeping them intimate? Oh, it's a shared secret. And so, what's the moral of the, you know, the story there? It's just tell the truth. Don't lie to yourself and others. I mean, you know, it's interesting how like in the beginning the show really had my attention. I was like, oh, this show is amazing. But as it progressed, it got weirder and weirder and it got stupid. And then I realized, oh, this was one of those situations. It should have just been a movie. It should not have been a show. Yeah. It was like way too long. If you drag something out that too, like that long, the story gets watered down. Today, when I was talking to my former professor, Vivian, she said that, you know, there's a difference between an ending and an end, right? Like, an ending just means it's an ending of a story, but there is no end. The end is unknowable, because we will never know the end. Just like we will never know death. Well, we all know we die, but we won't know death. Because we'll be dead. Right? So, anyway, I feel like the show should have just like stopped at a very weird ending, and it would have been actually a far better show. But yeah, I mean, they keep going until they ruin it. They kind of did that with A Killer Paradox too. Like the first three episodes were astounding, and then it just devolved into some weirdness as it progressed. I would actually say A Killer Paradox is a better show than The Frog because The Frog just started to really suck ass. Like when the little boy becomes like a, you know, a sniper and like that whole drama, I was just like, stop it, please. Just like in A Killer Paradox, when there was that diabetic murderer guy slinking around, I was like, okay, this is like getting weird. Like, I don't like it. I thought the colors and the aesthetics of the frog were remarkable, really astounding. Again, that actress, fucking amazing. I want to see her in more stuff. She's really beautiful. And I loved her manic acting, like when she goes to the supermarket and she's like running around, like buying stuff, and she's like in this manic state. And then later, when we see the older pension owner gentleman going shopping and he's going down the same aisles, picking the same things, you know? Like, again, what is the parallel between these two people? What makes them alike? I don't know. Like, what is the essential like thing that makes these two identical? Because like attracts like, that's law. So what is it that makes her and him identical? I still don't know. I'm not sure if the show creator knows either, but I don't know. Some of these sequences were beautifully shot and they seem to have meaning, but like I don't understand the point. And I'm usually good at it because I'm a scholar in this field. Hello. In any case, if you guys are not watching the other show right now, what is it? The Boy Next Door? With Chung Hae-in and Chun So-min. Oh my God. Phenomenal show. So we'll be talking about that soon. In the meantime, if you have not purchased my book, K-Drama School: A Pop Culture Inquiry into Why We Love Korean Television, it is available for purchase on Amazon, Target, Walmart, wherever you get your books. You can listen to this podcast on all your podcast platforms, and you can leave a review. Yes, you can leave 5 stars on iTunes and Spotify. You can also subscribe on YouTube, and you can support me on Patreon. kdramaschool.com is where you could get all this information, and I will see you all next week.